at a mystery library in the lobby with a small sign that read, "Free for guests. Please return before departure." Paul and Hank were stuck. They did not know for how long, but they assumed they would be in the Rutland Inn for a while. Despite the situation, they considered themselves lucky to have provisions to last them through the entire winter. Water, thanks to the snow, fuel, and companionship. The inn's honeymoon suite was a large room on the second floor with a fireplace and a hot tub. Paul and Hank heated the room at least once a week to bathe. Paul unpacked his solar shower, which they filled with warm water in the kitchen, before hanging it above the suite's tub. They found clothes in the inn's lost and found and the owner's quarters, and made themselves as comfortable as possible. The snow was so high that even if they found snowmobiles, they could not find the road. Neither Paul nor Hank knew the area well enough to risk going over a mountain in deep snow and sub-freezing temperatures. Their second week at the hotel brought Christmas. They did not exchange gifts, but they did make a feast from the gourmet pantry. Despite the uneven and high cooking temps of their wood stove, Paul was able to bake a small chocolate bûche de Noël. The brothers retired after their holiday feast to a fire in the main room and a vintage port from the wine cellar. "To us, brother, to us," Hank said, drunk but lucid enough to toast their luck. "We can ring in the new year next week, but I'm glad to put this one in the rearview. Despite a pleasant holiday with you, this has been the worst year of my life." Paul, also drunk, tipped his glass and took a sip. Hank tipped his glass, paused, and responded, "I have never known pain like I did this year. But you know what? I've never had to stop my life like I have this year either." He poured himself more port. "You and Megan, you lived your lives differently than I did. You traveled. You spent your weekends working on the house or at shows, movies. You lived." "We didn't have kids," Paul replied. "I know, I know. And I loved the girls, but that's not what I mean. These last days, sitting in this house, not working or worrying, decompressing about the last months, about my last 50 years, it's been incredible and cathartic. I cannot do anything right now. Literally, I can't do work. There is no way for me to get to Hanover. I have enough food, water, and fuel. I don't need to gather anything. I can't get to the mall. I can't call anyone." He sipped his port. "I don't have to work tomorrow. There isn't a college football game on TV. I have been forced to stop. I have to sit back and enjoy my time with you." "And?" Paul asked. Hank sipped his port. "I don't know. I still have an urge to do. I feel like we need to prep for something, but I don't know what. We can't plant. We can't build. I'm sucked in by a storm, perfectly comfortable and with months of provisions. It's made me slow down. I'm not taking stock of my life or saying I have regret in how I lived my life, but this pandemic, it's brought a new kind of order to my mind. It's simplified everything." Hank continued to drink. "I'm rambling because I'm a little drunk. What I think I'm trying to say, what I think I've realized is, the rapture has created a world where I can enjoy a game of cribbage with my brother. Before all of this destruction, my mind was always half somewhere else. I was thinking about work or mowing the lawn or whatever. I'm free of that now." He paused, took another sip of port. "The price was too high, but I had to pay it, you know? I feel like I should make the best of the bargain, make the best of the situation. Yes, this is the worst Christmas I've ever had. My life's partner, my 4 girls, they're all dead. But there's nothing I can do about that. To honor them, I will take the gift I earned from their deaths and savor it. I'll enjoy my life." Hank smiled. "This is great port." He raised his glass to the sky. Thank you, Steve and Nicole, for your fantastic taste and hospitality. Hank and Paul, having found the hotel's ownership information, frequently thanked their presumed dead benefactors. Hank started again. Do you know how many people I fired during my time at work? I didn't keep track, but it was north of 30. That's how I lived, climbing on the backs of others. It's how it used to be. Life isn't like that anymore. Life is pretty simple for us now. Eat, keep warm and dry, protect each other, go to sleep. Do I get to play golf? No. Will I miss a lot of things? Absolutely. But there is a purity to my life today. Hank leaned forward, rolling the port around in his glass as he spoke. He watched the maroon liquid swirl. You know why I burned my house and crawled in a hole for 2 months? Hank did not look up from the glass. You told me. To avoid the government. Paul put his hand on Hank's knee. He patted it, smiling at his drunk brother. Hank looked up to meet Paul's eyes. I wanted to die. I burned my old life to the ground and crawled into a grave next to my family. I never expected to come out of my tomb. I'm not sure I wanted to come out of my tomb. I debated killing myself, kept a gun in my hand, in my mouth, to my head almost every day. Tears rolled down Hank's face. He sat back, arms stretched out to either side. He and Paul sat by the fire on the highest holiday of the year, warm, dry, and fed. They had much to be angry about, but much to give thanks and praise for as well. Hank sniffed in his nose loudly. He used his sleeve to wipe tears from his face as others streamed down. As I said, I paid all I had for this new life. I don't want it, but it's mine now, and I'm going to accept it, enjoy it, and savor it while I can. Hank gulped the last of his port. You think anyone else is alive? You think Greg is making it through the winter, wherever the hell he is? Paul thought of his nephew every day. I know they are, Paul. I know they are. And just like us, they're sitting around a fire, cursing and giving blessings for the year. Hank placed his empty glass on the table before leaning onto his side and putting his feet on the couch. A loud, drunken snore erupted almost instantly. Merry Christmas, Hank, Paul whispered. He stood, steadied himself, and put two logs on the fire. He went back to his couch, still fully dressed like his brother, rested his head on his pillow, and fell asleep. Book 2 23 John, Matt, and Craig sat in the Charleston Harbor fishing. It was brisk out, but their desire for fresh fish outweighed their discomfort. They also felt the need to get out of the house after 3 days of rain. They used a boat for inlet fishing, one of many left along the harbor. It was early, 10:30 a.m., and they already had two good-sized sea bass. John wanted one or two more fish before he called it a day. The cold weather made him lean towards going in with his current haul. I got one, Craig said excitedly. Big one, too. You're going to feed us all today, little brother. Matt smiled and looked over at his father. If Craig landed the one on his line, he was responsible for two of the three fish. Craig reeled in his catch, another sea bass. It was almost double the size of the first two. He quickly baited his hook to recast his line. I think that's enough for one winter's morning, John said to his son. Matt reeled his empty line in 10 minutes earlier in hopes of heading home to a warm fire. I think you'd sit here all day fishing if we didn't stop you, Craig, he told his younger brother. Just one more? Craig asked. Matt and John looked at each other. Matt shrugged his shoulders with a what else do we have to do expression. Okay, but hurry up and get another one. I'm cold. John smiled. He reached over to a bag and pulled out a bottle of water. In the few months, the harbor was free of boat traffic. The fish made a tremendous jump in population. John knew it would not take long for Craig to catch another fish. They found Craig pedaling towards Myrtle Beach all those months ago. He was 30 miles from their house, a valiant effort for a young boy on a bike with only 6 gears. John hugged his son as Matt put the bike in the back of their SUV. Craig cried. He kicked. He screamed. He hit his father. "You're letting Greg die like you let Mom die," Craig yelled. John hugged him tightly. "I hate you, and I'm running away again tomorrow, and the next day, until I save my brother." But Craig did not run away again. Matt spent an hour with his younger brother that evening. They spoke behind a closed door, away from their father. When Matt came downstairs, he assured John the days of Craig fleeing were over. "You've had a rough few months, Matt. I have too, but you've had it worse than me. You lost your best friends, your football team, your girlfriend of, what, 2 years?" "Almost two. It would have been 2 years at New Year's," Matt replied. He sat on a couch next to his father. Craig was asleep upstairs, exhausted from his long day. "Greg is lost in Massachusetts or New Hampshire. Your other brother keeps running away, and to top it all off, your mother died." John paused. "I'm your father, and I will always be your father. But I need a friend as much as you do. I need a second in command, a partner to raise your brother, a partner to get us to Uncle Todd's, a friend to confide in when I don't know the answer. This isn't a great thing to ask of my 17-year-old son, barely old enough to drive, but it's something I have to ask of you. You've had a bad few months, and I can't promise things are going to get better. But consider today the day you become a man." Matt was serious since his girlfriend's death. His sense of humor was gone, and he seemed to be muddling through life. Before the rapture, Matt was a happy person, willing to laugh and joke through any situation. The end of the world snuffed out his spark. John needed to light it again. "You need to snap out of your haze, your depression, whatever is bothering you. I need you to start helping around the house, food gathering, cooking, wood gathering. You have to be a better influence and role model to Craig." John looked directly into Matt's eyes. "And above all else, I need you to be my friend." John stopped and let his words sink in. Matt stared at his father. He nodded slowly. "Okay, I get it. Okay." John could tell when Matt was lying, telling him what he wanted to hear. Matt had been lying for weeks. Tonight was not one of those times. In the last 2 minutes, John broke through the wall building between father and son since the beginning of the pandemic. "I can still call you Dad, though, right?" Matt knew the answer and asked with a partial smile. It was his first joke in weeks. "I'll always be your dad. But we have to fast-forward our relationship about 10 years, where I realize you were too old for me to boss around and we become friends." They stayed up late into the evening, talking about plans for the winter. Every day was a long day after the rapture. Matt was tired. He yawned, stood up, and said he was going to bed. He picked up his solar lantern and went to his room. Matt sat on the edge of his mattress for a few minutes. He pulled a backpack from under his bed and started to unpack his things. It was a large hiking pack he scavenged from a neighbor's house. Matt planned to leave Charleston to find Greg, abandoning his father and younger brother. After the conversation with John, Matt realized he was not leaving to save Greg. He was leaving to run away from himself. He was running away from his dead friends, girlfriend, and mother. He finished unpacking and shoved the empty bag back out of sight. Matt fell asleep the instant his head hit the pillow. Unlike previous nights, when he lay awake and planned his escape, Matt's life had a new purpose. His spirit was renewed, and his conscience cleared. He slept soundly for the first time in months. John found Matt's backpack earlier that week. He knew his son was planning to leave. John could not stop Matt. He could stop Craig, but Matt could drive. All he needed was a car. Matt had to want to stay. Matt had to want to help. John knew Matt had convinced Craig not to run away by telling him he was leaving to find Greg. When John found the empty pack under Matt's bed the next day, he knew their talk had worked. Every word of their conversation was real, and John held up his end of the bargain. Months later, as they sat in a boat in Charleston Harbor, John continued to treat Matt as an equal. Craig caught two more fish, a fourth sea bass, and a flounder. Matt turned the key on the whaler and powered the boat towards the pier. "Great fishing, Craig. You know the rule. He who catches cleans." "Man, I hate cleaning the fish when it's this cold out," he lied. Craig loved everything about fishing, the bait, the actual fishing, the cleaning. He even enjoyed eating fish. They pulled up to the dock, and Craig grabbed one of the fish, jumped onto the pier, and walked toward the end to clean his catch. He was a skilled angler and cleaned the first fish quickly. Matt tied up the boat, and John put the other fish on the pier for Craig to clean. "I like the flounder. You don't have to clean them. Just fillet and eat." Craig smiled at his father. He was becoming a resourceful young man. John feared Craig would lose his childhood to the plague. But in spite of everything, Craig still had the wonder of a 10-year-old. He flicked the fish guts off the dock and watched the seabirds and small sharks fight for the meal in the water below. The water was 8 feet below them and deep. When a larger shark, 8 feet long, lunged through the surface for the fish guts, Craig laughed in excitement.
"Dad, Matt, there's a huge shark right at the end of the pier. You have to see this."
The two men rushed over to watch the giant fish. It was a fitting end to a fun morning. They stood on the pier until John broke the silence. "We'll eat the flounder as soon as we get home, smoke the smaller bass, and ice the big bass for dinner. Sound like a plan?" John was excited for fresh fish. They had not fished for a week due to rain and cold mornings. The Dixons grabbed their gear and walked to a truck parked next to the dock. John found the small Toyota in town. It was perfect for hauling to and from the harbor. The Dixons moved out of their family home to escape their memories. They scouted Mount Pleasant, the town north of Charleston, landing in one of the island communities near the ocean. The family settled into a house with 5 fireplaces, built in the style of an old southern mansion. It was convenient to the fishing piers, and away from any main roads. John was not concerned about rapture survivors finding and threatening his family. During the outbreak, when scientists were studying the disease, the rapture was determined to be 99.99999% communicable. The chances of surviving were 1 in 1,000,000. South Carolina's population was around 4 million. There might be 1 or 2 others in the state. Probability suggested there were only 300 to 350 people in the entire country who might have survived the disease. Had all of these people been healthy otherwise? Had all of these people been old enough to survive on their own? Had any of these people needed medication to stay alive? Medication that was now gone. Had any of these people been old enough to pass away naturally since the disease began? John estimated there were at most 200 people alive in the United States. He guessed half of that 200, maybe more, traveled to California, Texas, or southern coastal areas to stay warm through the winter. John felt secure in Mount Pleasant, squatting for the winter months in a mammoth house near the ocean. His family was 50 miles from Interstate 95, the main artery of the East Coast. If there were large bands of roving survivors, they would skip the mild climate of Charleston for the warm temperatures of central and southern Florida. The truck was loaded and the fish were cleaned. Matt drove back to the mansion, as they called it. He parked and immediately walked around to the house's deck to start the grill. He was hungry, and lighting the fire meant he was closer to a flounder lunch. They would transfer the coals from the grill into the smoker after lunch, smoking and preserving the meat of the smaller sea bass. John and Craig made sure the rods and fishing gear were clean before they exited the garage and walked into the house. John was washing his hands in the sink when Matt came in from off of the deck. "Fire is going.
We should be ready to cook in a few, Matt said. I'll put a pot of water on so we can have rice or noodles.
Craig is putting the fish on ice. John looked out the window as he rubbed his hands together. They kept lemon-scented liquid soap at the sink to rid their hands of the fish smell. Their house was several rows away from the water, but he could see the harbor from the kitchen window.
Let's do rice. It goes better with fish, don't you think?
They considered several locations and homes. All of the homes had some kind of generator or backup energy system. This particular house had two, a gas generator they used occasionally, and solar panels that powered a few items during the daylight hours, including a water pump and water heater. Initially, after moving into the solar house, John and the boys lived like they did before the rapture. They kept multiple lights on, played video games, plugged appliances in all the time, and used the garage door opener. They learned quickly that plugged-in appliances use power, and their solar power cells were consistently drained each evening. Their gas generator would turn on and burn precious fuel. The only appliance plugged into a wall socket was the refrigerator. When they needed light, they used one lamp or they lit candles. They set a limit to television, movies, and video games. As the days grew colder and shorter, energy was conserved for electric heaters. The solar panels allowed them to keep parts of their old life during the day and kept them attached to their old humanity. Learning to conserve energy taught them the new life of finite heat and light. 4 5-gallon coolers of water sat on the counter next to the stove, boiled and purified the day before. The kitchen looked like a sporting event, as the yellow and red coolers were mainstays at soccer, baseball, and football games. Matt pressed the white spigot at the bottom of the cooler by placing his thumb on the button. He measured 4 cups into a pot and walked outside to boil the water on the grill. He rarely used the indoor stove. With the water started, he went back inside to select a packet of Just Add Water rice from the hundreds stored in the kitchen pantry. "I feel Caribbean today," he mumbled to himself, pulling a green box from the shelf. Matt typically cooked fish on aluminum foil. It was an easy cleanup. He poured olive oil on the foil, put the filleted and skinned flounder down, and generously applied seasoning. He waited for the water to boil and the rice to cook before he started the fish. Flounder cooked in just a few minutes. It was Monday. Matt and Craig had school. John established a school schedule once their lodging and food were secured. Craig could not continue through life with a 5th-grade education. Craig did not need to learn much more, but he did need basic math, physics, and better reading and writing skills. Matt was a senior in high school. He had a firm base of education to get him through the rest of his life. One of his new roles was to tutor Craig. John was too far removed from school to be an effective educator. One day a week, all three of the Dixons learned and practiced basic survival skills, like starting a fire without matches and making snare traps. Monday meant a visit to the local library, located just 3 blocks from their house. Matt found books on math, engineering, physics, survival, and most importantly, farming. He was obsessed with planting crops and setting up irrigation systems once he traveled to Hanover. New Hampshire had a short growing season. He studied which vegetables he could grow, how to harvest the seeds after the season, rotating the crops, watering the crops, pest control. He studied canning and how much food they would need for a group of 10 or more. Matt and John studied livestock, how to milk a cow, how to pasteurize milk, how to slaughter animals, how to mate and grow a herd. There were endless topics to learn if they hoped to survive in the new world. Before the pandemic, they did not know which berries were edible. They spent Monday through Thursday learning what they could eat. As he waited for the rice to cook on the grill, Matt looked at math worksheets for Craig. He also paged through an edible plants book for his younger brother to read and write a 1-page book report on by Friday. John and Craig stood in the kitchen chatting about fishing and laughing about John not catching anything for the 3rd outing in a row. "Maybe Matt will share some of his farming books with you, Dad. You don't seem to be able to catch anything lately. Growing might be your thing." "Okay, so I'm a little cold. I'll get my lucky touch back.
Wait until we get to New Hampshire and I can fish with worms. I'll be much better there.
He smiled as Craig continued to rib him. The sun poked through the clouds, and the temperature warmed 10 degrees. Craig walked to the sink to wash his hands. John went out on the deck and let the breeze blow in his face. It was still cool, 55 degrees, but a warm breeze blew from the south.
The wind is up from the south again today.
He looked over his shoulder at Matt, standing by the grill and watching the rice pot.
That's 2 weeks. It's time to go.
It's still cold in the morning. Think how bad it will be in New Hampshire. It's only February.
Matt was comfortable where he was. He did not want to leave.
I like this house, too. I like the ocean. I like how safe we are, and having electricity, and heat, and food. But we need to get up to Hanover and start a life with our entire family. Don't forget for 1 minute that you have a brother up there alone, probably not living in a solar house, eating fresh flounder and rice.
John did not speak with anger or admonishment. He used a matter-of-fact tone.
We cannot let our comfort cloud Greg's situation, which is probably dire.
Matt knew his father was right. It took him a second to reply, but when he did, his voice acknowledged he was ready.
When do we go?
Matt asked. We make a list of things we should take. We pick a vehicle we can load with extra gas and operates off-road if necessary. We pack up and leave this week. John stated the obvious. And we frame this as nothing but positive to Craig. You should work with him today on school. Maybe mention he will be the teacher when we hook up with his cousins.
Okay. I'll start to prep him, and I'll get the books we might need for the trip. The extended cab Suburban is going to be the best option. We can fill it with food and water, convert the third row into a bed. The fuel economy stinks, but getting fuel is not a problem right now. It's also a beast off-road in the grass and mud. I'll start to pack.
Can we have some lunch first?
I'm starving, John said with a smile.
You're always so serious. Lighten up a little bit.
John's smile widened. Matt was seldom serious. John enjoyed teasing him.
Someone has to be the adult in the house. Another reason the Suburban is a good call? I was never taught how to drive stick, leaving army vehicles out of my capability.
Matt walked away from his still-smiling father in a mock huff. Craig listened to the conversation from the other side of the sliding glass door.
"So I guess you heard all of that," John said in a loud voice, so Craig knew he was talking to him.
John pushed the door open and walked inside.
"Yeah,"
Craig replied in a sheepish voice that said he knew he should not have been listening.
"What do you think?" John asked.
Craig proved himself to be a valuable member of the group. John spoke to him with the respect he deserved. While not a decision-maker, Craig was always allowed input.
I miss Greg. I want to leave. I don't care about this house or any of this stuff. I want to find my brother.
Craig stood tall as he spoke to his father.
I also like the idea of bossing around 2 kids younger than me. You tell me what I need to do. I'll pack up and leave whenever you tell me.
Heck, I tried to leave months ago.
Craig smiled at his joke.
We'll leave as soon as we can, but not before I eat the fish you caught.
Let's set the table and enjoy. John walked over to Craig and roughed up his son's mop of a hairdo. Both of his sons had grown up in the last few months, more than John realized. John, Matt, and Craig sat at a round table in the kitchen's breakfast nook next to a bank of windows. The clouds were gone, and the sun beamed welcome rays and warmth through the panes. They laughed and ate, enjoying lunch a little longer than usual. It was their last fresh meal at the mansion. Matt did not give Craig the math worksheets or edible plants book. Their afternoon was spent packing and preparing for the departure to Raleigh, North Carolina.
24.
Hubba sat on his bed in the corner of the kitchen, watching the people run around. He was used to excitement and commotion. He stretched out his front legs, closed his eyes, and waited for his call to the study later in the day. The kitchen was his favorite haunt. The nice men in white jackets always flipped him food. The people running around the mansion were not nice today. They were frenzied. Hubba did not understand what was happening, but again, he was used to commotion. He happily drifted off to sleep in the sunny corner of the kitchen. Maybe the white coats would show up later, giving him a few snacks before his evening meal of kibble. "What about the dog?" one of the men asked.
"Forget the dog. They're supposed to be carriers. Did you see the reports from Brazil? He'll be dead soon anyway. My dog died last week. He was old. I thought it was age. Now I know better."
"So we just leave him here? He'll starve. That's cruel. You want to bring a terminal disease-carrying dog with us to Asheville? You'll never get through the security checkpoints. That dog stays here. Take it outside and shoot it, or open a bag of food and leave it on the ground if you want, but it ain't coming with us. The governor left on the plane this morning. Her kid has a fever. I doubt she's worried about the dog."
The first man shrugged his shoulders. He went to the cupboard and pulled out a bag of Hubba's food. He set the bag on the floor and tore the top open all the way. He placed two large roasting pans full of water on the floor next to the food.
"Good luck, buddy," he said to the sleeping dog.
He ran out of the kitchen, letting the door swing closed behind him and shutting the bolt at the top. Hubba woke up later in the day. All the people were gone. He knew it would be calm at some point, but did not expect to be alone. It was unusual for no one to be in the kitchen. He walked over to his automatic water bowl and slurped, splashing water over the back and both sides of his dish. The bowl had 2 gallons of water, inverted in a jug, and would refill the bowl if the water fell below a certain level. Hubba watched the air bubble glug in the plastic jug, signaling more water filling his bowl. He had to go to the bathroom. He always did after he drank. He walked to the back door and hit it with his paw. No one came. He hit the door again. He waddled to the swinging door that led to the rest of the house. He hit it with his paw. No one came. He barked. He waddled to the back door, lifted his leg, and peed on the floor. He went back to his bed and fell asleep. Hubba was an evolutionary wonder. Typically, the strongest and most adapted of a species moves along the evolutionary ladder. Hubba was a standard bulldog, a breed that is almost exclusively delivered cesarean, typically cannot breed without in vitro fertilization, and has no ability to hunt. Yet Hubba was the last of his kind. Canines fell victim to the rapture, or a mutated form of the rapture. Unlike apocalyptic movies with packs of wild dogs roaming the landscape, the post-rapture world was void of wolves, coyotes, dogs, and dingoes. Despite being abandoned by the governor of North Carolina, Hubba survived 75 days in filth with little food and water. Today, he slept happily on the front porch of his new owner's house. It was warm outside, but the red brick landing was cool from the night's low temperature. Hubba had the best of both worlds, a hot sun baking his back and cool rocks on his belly. It was good to be Hubba again. Winter was over, spring had sprung, and he had a new family that loved him. His ears perked up as a large black truck pulled into his cul-de-sac. He lifted his head off the brick, stood up, and barked wildly. Todd looked out the front window to see why his dog was barking. He saw the black SUV with red fuel canisters strapped to the roof and back. He grabbed a shotgun off the top shelf of his coat closet and went to the second floor. He wanted the element of surprise and the advantage of position over the strangers in the truck. The black vehicle pulled into the driveway. Todd heard doors open and shut as he made his way up the back stairs.
"Todd? Anyone home?"
It was John's voice. Todd was halfway up the staircase when he froze, ran back down and opened the back door to the garage.
"John, you're a month early. I was about to shoot you."
Todd ran over and threw his arms around his brother.
"It got warm. We decided to drive up."
"Man, is it good to see you. Are your boys alive? Are they here?"
John asked with apprehension. Tears of joy ran down his face, but worry clouded his questions.
Yes, yes, they're in the woods. Todd looked over at Matt and Craig.
Oh, my gosh. Look how tall you are. I haven't seen you guys in a year or more. You're huge. Get over here. Let me give you a hug.
Todd pulled Matt in. His nephew was significantly taller than him. Todd began to cry. He was the emotional brother. He held Matt tightly.
Get over here too, Craig. Give me a hug.
He reached his hand out and grabbed his nephew by his shirt, pulling him in for a hug. Todd felt John's big arms wrap around the three of them.
God damn, I missed you guys,
Todd sobbed as he hugged his brother and nephews. John felt an animal nudging his calf.
Where in the world did you find a dog? Didn't all the dogs die? What the hell is this beast doing alive?
He bent down and gave Hubba a scratch. The dog panted, losing his breath during the short run from the front porch.
That's a long story. His name is Hubba.
Matt! Craig!
Brian and Jay were screaming and running across the backyard after spotting their cousins. When they got to the edge of the driveway, they slowed in an attempt to act cool.
Hey,
Brian said to Matt, flipping his head up casually.
Hey? You come here, little dude.
He picked Brian up and flipped him over. Brian's feet were next to Matt's face.
It's been a while since I played the Brian guitar.
Matt proceeded to strum tickles on Brian's tummy in mock guitar play. Brian was screaming with laughter, begging his cousin to stop. Craig looked over at a smiling Jay.
I think this is a dueling guitar number. Jay bolted towards the backyard and the play equipment.
Matt put Brian down.
You have 3 seconds before I play my second number.
Brian screamed and ran. Matt turned to his uncle. The game's afoot. Todd turned to John and gave him another hug, tight and full of love.
I knew you'd be here. I knew it. I hung up the phone 4, maybe 5 months ago and thought, he's still alive. He's coming. But then everyone died. Everyone. And I questioned if I was sane to believe my entire family would survive.
Todd cried again.
I know, Todd. I know.
They broke their hug, stepping back.
Do you need anything?
Todd asked.
Food, water, anything.
No, no, I'm good. We had a huge breakfast. Lots of food and drink on the way up. I'm good.
John bent down to pet the dog again.
How was your winter?
John got down to business. Has it been tough? Are the boys okay?
They're young to lose their mother and all their friends.
To steal from Mark Twain, the reports of my death have been greatly exaggerated. John heard a woman's voice respond from behind him. He spun around.
What? You're alive?
He walked to Emily slowly. He placed his hands on the outside of her arms, holding her as if she were a mannequin.
How? How did you live? How is it possible?
He pulled her into his body and wrapped his arms around her.
I don't know. The same way you did, I guess?
She could tell John was shaken by her survival, like he was hugging a ghost.
Dude, you gonna stop hugging my wife? I know we're brothers, but I think I have to fight you if you don't stop soon. Plus, I think it's been a while since you've seen a woman.
John did not let go. He hugged Emily as if he was hugging his own wife.
I just assumed you were dead. My God, it's good to see you. Megan and Jenny both died. I'm sorry.
He pulled away and looked at her again.
It's unbelievable. Like a miracle.
I think our boys have taken yours into the woods to show them the big fort they've been working on all winter. It's pretty cool back there. I'm sure you'll get a chance to check it out. Emily knelt down to pet Hubba.
Hey, did you meet our dog? I picked him up downtown last fall.
John was in shock. Tears streamed down his face. He expected to find his brother and nephews, but seeing Emily was too much for him to handle.
Can I walk around a little? I drove the entire way.
John continued to keep a hand on his sister-in-law.
Absolutely.
Do you want to walk around the neighborhood? Todd could tell John was rattled.
How about you let me go and I take you into the woods to see the fort? Emily said. John released her, wiping his tears and nose on his long-sleeved shirt. He walked to his truck and reached through the open driver's window for his bottle of water.
How were the highways and roads? Did you take 95 the whole way?
Todd had not ventured beyond Raleigh.
I made it in 2.5 hours. We drove 100-plus the entire way.
Insane. No cars. Literally open highway. There was one roadblock we had to drive around, some kind of barricade or something at the state line, but it was minor. I hesitate to call it a roadblock.
John took another swig as he walked into the backyard.
I did notice that some of the exits into towns were blocked off, like people didn't want visitors coming off the highway, but the highway itself was clear. They could hear the kids yelling, laughing, and playing.
I've tried so hard to give Craig a childhood since this all started. I guess it was easier with 2 young ones.
John paused.
Had more setbacks than you.
What's the word on Greg?
He's obviously not with you,
Emily asked curiously. The last time I spoke to him, he was up at school, safe in the dorm. I told him to wait until he thought everyone was dead before making a break to Hanover for the winter. It's why we came up a month early. If it's warm down here, maybe it's warm up there.
John stopped.
I'm so glad you're alive.
It's a bright spot in the horrible nightmare we're all living.
John cleared his throat.
Can you do me a favor and not talk about Greg too much with Craig and Matt? I don't know how long it will take us to get up there, if the roads are blocked around New York, if we have to go through the mountains. Who the hell knows? Let's keep it as casual as we can.
Sure, John, sure.
Todd looked at Emily. She nodded. John turned back towards the gate in the fence that led to the woods behind the house. Todd reached out and grabbed Emily's hand, squeezing it. He smiled at her. It felt great to have other people around.
Matt, Craig, come over here and say hello to Aunt Emily.
The boys looked up from behind a wall of sticks and leaves. They ran over for the reunion. Emily cried. Craig was bashful. Matt acted mature, but also cried. The Dixon reunion party lasted for the rest of the day. Todd thawed hamburgers, an exciting treat for John, Todd, and Craig. Emily made orzo salad, and they opened a few cans of corn. Everyone laughed and played while enjoying an old-fashioned cookout. Hubba made sure there were no leftover burgers. At 7:30, the young kids were asleep. Craig was on the upper bunk in Jay's room. Brian made his upper bunk up for Matt, but did not stay up for his bunkmate to come to bed. The youngest Dixons were exhausted after the long and exciting day. Emily, Matt, John, and Todd sat at the kitchen table. Solar lamps illuminated the room. John enjoyed a beer. His shoulders relaxed as tension left his body. Finding Todd and Emily shifted burden from him to other members of his family.
"So you haven't seen anyone else alive?
No one?" Matt asked. He played with his brother and cousins all afternoon. This was his first chance to speak with the adults.
"Just Hubba," Emily answered.
"We kept low for several months before actively seeking others. We gave up in October. As far as we can tell, there is no one else alive in Raleigh. If there were survivors, they left during the initial outbreak, and they haven't come back."
"How are you on supplies? I mean, if you served us burgers tonight, I guess you're doing pretty well."
John could tell that his brother was well-stocked. He wanted to know exactly how well-stocked.
"We're doing well on supplies. Raleigh was unique. Everyone left. The stores were abandoned and left full of food. Hell, I have a warehouse store down the road with enough canned food to feed 100 people for a year."
Todd paused.
"I'm worried about 2 or even 3 years out more than I am 2 months out. When all this pre-made stuff is gone or rotten, when we can't find canned tuna or pasta, when all the flour goes bad, if we don't know how to do it ourselves, we're screwed."
"I know. But at least we have 2, maybe 3 years to figure out how to make and find our own food."
John looked at his beer.
"We have a long time to talk about this stuff. Let's focus on what's been happening. I have to hear the story of that guy.
He tipped his beer glass towards the snoring dog in the corner.
That, my dear brother-in-law, Emily paused for effect, is the first dog of North Carolina.
She told the tale of finding the dog on her mansion tour. John and Matt laughed so hard they cried at some of her stories. Todd sat back and smiled as his wife entertained them. It was a great night, the best any of them had since the rapture.
Todd and Emily's house was cold in the mornings, not as cold as it had been in the winter, when the entire family moved mattresses down to the living room to sleep next to the fire, but cold enough that all of them wore heavy shirts or light jackets inside.
"The standing house rules," Todd began. "The first person awake puts a fire bundle in the fireplace along with two logs, lets hubba out, and presses the coffee maker button. The coffee maker runs on batteries. It was by far my greatest find. Emily can endure a lot of hardship, but not having coffee is not one of them."
Todd made the fire bundles in advance, forming small sticks, dry leaves, and old newspapers into a loose mass of tinder. There were typically a few coals left from the night before. The fire bundle, when put on the hot ashes, would catch after a few minutes, and was a safe way for his young boys to start the fire each morning. Emily did not like her 6- and 7-year-olds playing with fire, but realized that her new reality meant the boys had to learn how to make and sustain fire safely. The adults said their goodnights and were asleep before 10 p.m.
Todd was usually the first one up, or he would wake when he heard Jay or Brian go downstairs. If Todd was up first, he would make the fire from scratch, conserving the fire bundles. If he came down with one of the boys, he would walk them through making the fire. This morning was different. Todd heard Jay come out of his room, talking to his cousin Craig.
"We have to start the fire to heat up the living room, then let Hubba out, and then press the coffee button. You do not want to see my mom if she doesn't get coffee. Seriously, she's like a bear. We call her Mommy Bear if she doesn't get coffee."
Their voices trailed off as they went downstairs. Todd rolled over and looked at Emily. She was smiling. Her eyes were still closed.
"He's right about that," Todd said to her.
She opened her eyes.
"Are you going to talk to John about Hanover?"
"He has to go. His son is up there. There's no option for him. If he and the boys go, you know I believe we should all go."
"I know. But we can't live up there. It doesn't make any sense. It's too harsh. We can't grow anything, and there's no reason to put ourselves through those conditions. My boys are too young. Hanover was fine when we thought other people might be alive, when we were concerned about lawlessness or chaos. Everyone is dead. We can live anywhere. We can live here."
"Emily, you and I have talked about this. We're going. We don't have a choice. Greg is up there. Hank and Paul are up there. If we end up back here, or down in Florida, or somewhere like that, okay. But I think you have to resign yourself that we are staying together, and that means going to Hanover. You need to talk to John before we go, so he understands it will be an up-and-back excursion. Maybe float the idea that you two go alone. I can stay here with Matt and the kids."
"Okay, okay. Let's feel out the situation."
Halfway through the short but cold North Carolina winter, Todd reconsidered a move to New Hampshire. As he and Emily discussed their options, it made sense to live in a place like North Carolina or Virginia, where the winters are mild and the growing seasons are long. A place like Florida created the opposite problem to New Hampshire. The summers are too hot and oppressive. Todd and Emily discussed the topic endlessly, deciding the mid-Atlantic states were their best option. They wanted to settle and get seeds in the ground as soon as possible. On one of their many family days out, they visited a family farm amusement park. Emily picked the park because it had big slides and fun buildings, rather than mechanical rides requiring power. Similar to Pullen Park, the farm had a diesel train Todd was able to get working. The train went around a large oval and was considered lame by Jay and Brian. Todd agreed about the ride, but what he noticed during their trip around the track was the antique farming equipment on display.
The owner had an incredible collection of old-time tillers and seed row makers, things that Todd thought would be useful in their new life. He went back to the farm the next day and unbolted several pieces of equipment, loading as much of it as he could into a U-Haul van. The equipment was in a neighbor's driveway, ready for use this spring. The farm amusement park also had livestock, which Todd and Emily adopted. Goats, chickens, roosters, and rabbits lived in their neighbor's backyard in hutches and coops built last fall. Goats were a source of milk and easier to manage than cows, and they ate just about anything given to them. The chickens were a source of eggs and meat. The rabbits were delicious. Todd and Emily were not eager to leave their safe and sustainable family compound to brave a northern New England winter. Todd got out of bed and went downstairs. Jay took Craig next door to gather the morning's eggs. Their hen population was growing, thanks to Emily's incubator. There were more than enough eggs for the three additional mouths. The coffee was done. Todd placed sugar in a cup and poured himself a steaming mug of morning energy. He moved from the kitchen to the living room, where the fire was warming the cold morning air. John came down the stairs and sat in a chair across from his brother and near the fire. We had a solar-powered house in Charleston, right next to the bay. It was fantastic. We fished for our meals, kept the house warm with electric heat, ran lights at night. I believe we could have lived down there for quite a while.
Until a hurricane slammed into you without warning, Todd replied.
Well, yes, until a hurricane came. John pointed to the coffee. Do you mind?
John, you are not a guest. Everything we have is yours. We have to think as a single family or unit, not two families that are visiting each other. Yes, take some coffee.
You don't have to freak out because I politely asked for coffee in your house. John was not used to Todd being the serious one. Todd was the youngest, the funny one, the sarcastic brother who was seldom, if ever, serious.
You know what? Now you can't have any coffee.
Good luck with that. I'm taking the coffee. The men watched through the back windows as Jay and Craig walked towards the house with a basket of eggs. Jay was non-stop talking to Craig, telling him about everything he could. Craig smiled and nodded. He was a great older cousin and understood his role. They opened the back door and walked in.
So you have to be really careful with the goats because they're mean sometimes and hiss at you, but we still milk them. You put their heads in this wood thing that my dad made and then you can milk them.
So where's my goat's milk for my coffee? John asked Jay.
I don't milk the goats alone. I was just explaining that to Craig. It's a two-person job, and we usually do it in the afternoon when it's warmer.
Jay was a fountain of knowledge. There's milk in the fridge in the garage. The food stays cold in there right now, Todd offered to John. It's on the shelf below where you got the beer.
Oh, okay. I was just kidding, but I'll take it. Great.
John got up and walked into the garage to get the milk. Todd went onto the back porch, still in his slippers and robe, to light his pizza oven. Designed by a famous American cook, the oven was large enough for several items, but small enough to light every day without burning too much wood. Todd made bread, pizza, and roasted meats. This morning he was going to bake bread from dough he made before going to bed. He placed a large cast-iron pan on one side of the oven to preheat for an herb frittata. He came back inside to knead the dough into shape.
I will repeat my accolades from last night. That is one sweet pizza oven.
John was in awe.
It's portable, and is coming with us wherever we go.
We're going to Hanover, though, right? John looked at his brother after the wherever we go statement.
Of course. But if we pick a place after Hanover, it goes with us.
Todd did not avert his eyes. He answered firmly, directly.
Okay, John replied slowly.
Craig and Jay did not pay attention to the exchange. They continued to talk about stuff.
We usually have toast and eggs, or maybe pancakes and eggs for breakfast. I guess we're having fresh bread, which can take a while, because my dad needs to heat the oven. He usually lets us have a granola bar or a cereal bar or something like that until the big breakfast is ready. Do you want one?
There was no one more excited to talk to other people than Jay. He was a chatterbox. The previous options of Mom, Dad, and Brother knew all his stories. Introducing new people gave him a new audience.
I'm good, Craig replied. You want to go kick the soccer ball around until breakfast is ready?
Craig was equally excited to meet up with younger people who would play.
Yes!
Jay did a gesture with his arm, making a fist and pulling it down so his arm was bent.
I'll call you when breakfast is ready. Have fun,
Todd said as Jay and Craig pulled on heavier coats.
Okay, they both replied, running out the door.
We have a good life here. The growing season is longer. The winters are mild. The summers are hot, but not horrible. It's a nice place, John. A great place to consider.
Wait a second, John started. Wasn't Hanover your idea? Aren't we heading up there because you suggested it 6 months ago? Now you don't want to go?
A lot has changed, John. Look at the animals I've gathered. Look at the weather here in February. You know there are still snowstorms headed towards Hanover. 6 months ago, I didn't know how this would all shake out. Now we do know. There aren't roving bands of marauders that we have to avoid. There hasn't been a military crackdown. 6 months later, we're it. Emily and I need support to raise our kids. You need support to raise your kids. I can't make this decision alone, but I can tell you, Hanover is not the best option for survival.
John nodded. He agreed.
We screw up in New Hampshire. We have no options. We're dead. We screw up here, miss the harvest, bugs eat our food. We can get to the coast and eat fish.
I know. Up there, we freeze and starve.
Let's forget about long term for now. We have to go. Your son is up there. Our brothers are meeting us there. I'm not saying my house is the best option. Maybe your solar house on the coast is better. But we have to discuss our future. Emily and I are not going to move to Hanover just because we said we would during the chaos of a pandemic.
So today's discussion is not where to live, it's when we leave, John said as he drank his coffee.
Yep. Right now we talk about getting up there. We'll talk about where we live later. As long as you agree, it isn't Hanover.
Brian came downstairs asking where Jay and Craig were. Todd and John pointed outside and said one word. Soccer. Brian pulled his shoes on as fast as he could, screaming thanks as he ran out the door. Emily was next into the kitchen. She walked straight to the coffee pot.
Who has been drinking my coffee?
She stared at John. You brought your own pot and coffee, right?
Nope, John said, taking a long, dramatic sip from his cup.
It's only the second day. But I'm not sure this is going to work,
Emily said to Todd.
He's your brother, so please talk to him about the rules. Rule one, don't touch my coffee. Rule number two is to follow rule one, and you'll do fine.
Todd turned to John. Don't drink all the coffee. We need Emily to drink her coffee.
Apparently, John replied. Emily smiled as she poured herself a cup.
So what's on the agenda today? She asked bluntly.
I say we enjoy ourselves for a few days while we try to plan our next steps.
Is that what you're thinking? John answered.
That sounds like a great idea. We have a lot to talk about, and a lot of decisions to make.
Emily knew her husband broached the subject of Hanover and where they should settle.
But first, let's figure out how we're going to feed our kids and what sort of fun we want to have.
She took a sip from her mug. There's a lot of fun stuff we can take Craig to today. We have working trains, slides, paddle boats, fishing.
I think he'll be happy to play in the street with his cousins all day. It's been a while since he's had other kids his age to kick or throw a ball with.
John looked out the front windows. He smiled at his son playing with his cousins. He's had a hard time. I love that he can finally play.
Todd spread olive oil and salt over the top of his bread, getting ready to put it in the oven outside. He poked his fingers into the top and sprinkled sliced shallots and rosemary onto the focaccia.
Well, you're here now. We'll let the kids enjoy a few days before we talk about next steps.
He continued to work, cracking a dozen of the eggs into a large bowl with a fair amount of goat's milk. He began to whisk the bowl, stopping to add salt and pepper before whisking again. Todd had the dough in a pan on a large pizza paddle. He picked it up to walk out to the pizza oven and start baking his morning bread. It would not